Not going to preach a sermon, but there's something from the scripture that runs in my head that I might take as a text. I have been young and am now old. you can see that I'm now old, and perhaps you can take my word for it that I was once young. And I'm going to give a few rambling, disorganized reminiscences that spread through, well, a quarter of my life. The first one came when I was 15 years old, and I'm going to take my cutoff point as 1914. I have to start somewhere. And that's, I shan't say much of anything about anyone now living. Some, but not very much. About, for a reason that will appear in time. Well, the earliest reminiscence that I have in mind came in 1893 when I was taken into the house, a rented house that David Day had taken in Chicago, not very far from the World's Fair grounds, because he was in charge of the mineral exhibits there. And Major Powell was staying in the house at the same time, and I saw him occasionally, sat at the same dinner table with him once or twice. And I have a vivid recollection of him. I remember particularly the way he looked at a person to whom he was talking. He never talked to me, but he talked to some other people, and he half closed his eyes and looked very directly and intently and spoke quite deliberately. Seemed to be very careful to make sure that what he said got across and was understood. Well, that's the first director of the surveys I ever saw. He was director then. I'd invented the survey for some years. So, some years later, and it was at the suggestion of David Day, by the way, who was a cousin of my mother. But, he was the second director, and so I have seen all of them except the very first, Clarence King. And even my oldest friend, Arthur Spencer, God bless him, and never saw Clarence King, although he once wrote a letter to him, which King didn't answer because he was an invalid at the time. Well, I had pretty close relations with two later directors who come up in turn. I entered on my first work as a field assistant, though not a, excuse me for crushing you, I shouldn't do it because I didn't become a permanent employee until later. But at any rate, in 1900, I went to Ellensburg, and on a beautiful day toward the end of April, I was met at the station by George Otis Smith, and I remember very well how he looked, how I was impressed by his handsome appearance and his kindliness and his air of authority all combined. And I remember too that in the cool of the evening on the same day, he gave me a little filling in on the geology of the region. He had in the previous year finished with Mendenhall mapping the geology of Mount Stewart quadrangle, and Mount Stewart stood up high on the skyline. Didn't see it all yet. You remember some of those far off things better than we do. Things that happened yesterday. And, well, I was assistant to George Otis for three seasons. We mapped the 30-minute Ellensburg quadrangle in one season. One doesn't do those things nowadays. And of course, what we did a decorated speed, all has to be done over again, and perhaps more than once. But at any rate, we roughed it out. And then the next year was perhaps one of the most adventurous that I ever had. We were given the job of, checking up on the condition of the monument along the 49th parallel. They'd been put there, I think, about 60 years before. And that was ostensibly what we went up there for, but we incidentally did some geological reconnaissance. A good deal of our route was without trails, but it so happened that the part without trails was rather better going than one of the trails that we went over for a bit 90 miles. It's called the Goat Trail, appropriately, and there's one part of it that, I guess there's a stretch about as long as this room, and it consisted of two or three planks overlapping, about 18 inches wide and maybe a couple of inches thick, and they were suspended by wire cables from iron pins driven into a slightly overhanging granite cliff. And the Skagit River was boiling along 30 feet or so below or so. Well, we didn't check all the boundary monuments along the stretch of time to us. There's one part of it that's been practically impossible to get to in the time we had, and George Otis was realistic about what he could do at a given time, so we bypassed that. But one little thing that I remember is that I first saw Daly there. I was going along a trail west of the Cascades in a heavily wooded country and looking for a boundary monument. This trail led along a rushing stream, and presently I caught sight of a big man with auburn whiskers or a full auburn beard standing on a big boulder in midst of the stream, and that was Reginald Daly. And we had a few little conversations. Then the next year, 1902, we did perhaps more than half of the Snoqualmie quadrangle, which was another 30 minutes one, and was a very complicated geology. And I guess everything considered, you have to consider everything stuff like that. We did it pretty well. It's R. and Waters, who has reviewed a lot of our work, that it's pretty good considering. Foster has said has expressed his admiration of George Otis Smith, and I don't know that I have anything more to add than what is rather superficial, that he had a personality that was impressive, not so pretentious, but he had the look and the manner of a leader. He always knew he was boss. He always knew he was around when he was around, and never could get out of it. Brings me to remark on a difference of custom in the use of names. In those days, people very seldom used first names unless they were very well acquainted. I'm referring to George Otis Smith and George Otis. A lot of people did. They sometimes addressed him as George Otis, but I do not remember anyone ever addressing him as plain George. And he never called me anything but Calkins, and I never called him anything but Mr. Smith. That's his customer. You use Mr. for a person older and of higher rank. The term doctor is seldom used. There's nobody that just called me doctor. The change of custom was very certainly brought home to me just about a week ago when, on leaving the office, I ran into George Isaacs, George Otis's grandson, and his little son Randy, just short of 4 years old, and George Otis's great grandson. And Randy, without any prompting, looked at me and said, "Hello, Frank." Well, so it is. Children are allowed or encouraged to do that, and I'm continually greeted as hello Frank now by people whose old names I'm not sure of. I'm happy about confessing that, but I'm hard of hearing and my memory isn't what it used to be and never was. But there's something to be said perhaps on both sides of that. There may have been some advantages in recognizing differences of age and rank in the old-fashioned way. But I must say I enjoy the new way. I don't know whether I ought to say it makes me feel younger. I think perhaps it ought to be the other way around, because I'm being called Frank in my old age a great deal oftener than I was in my youth. If I recall, Mr. Hawkins might be too younger. Well, I'm rather quibbling on that. In the Snoqualmie Quadrangle, I first became acquainted with a man who was in the field more seasons than anybody else. That his name was Donald Francis McDonald. He was from Nova Scotia, and he'd somehow gotten into the employ of the Hudson's Bay Company and had been a factor. I suppose he was in charge of a company store upon the Stikine River in western Canada. Before very long that there wasn't any particular future in that. And he somehow got down to Seattle and got into the university. Got interested in, in geology, and he got a job with us in that year 1902 as a packer. And well, he was in parties of mine after that for, I was going with every year for about 5 years. I know he was in 1907, and thereby hang the tale which we'll come to presently. Well, old MacDonald was a very estimable character, we gave him a geologic chores to do from the very first, and more as time went on. In 1907, his title was changed to field assistant or assistant geologist. He went on, in the course of time, he became geologist of the Panama Canal Commission and did other things, but was very successful on the whole. Well, he was a big man, and strongly built, not at all a muscle flexing type, but in between seasons, he went to Georgetown University, or George Washington University, and to keep himself in trim, he went in for wrestling. He came to me one morning with an air of something like wonder on his face and said the night before that he'd had a match with a policeman who was regarded as the amateur heavyweight champion wrestler of Washington. And said to him, "Why, Joe, I threw it." Max never used any expletive stronger than "by Joe," and he used that rather frequently, and it always came at the climax of any little story he was telling. Well, the next thing was the Coeur d'Alene district, supposed to be assisting Ransom there, but Ransom was grabbed by Lyndon to work with him in the Cripple Creek district. That was considered very, very urgent, and so Ransom didn't come into the Coeur d'Alene until 1904, when he did the mining geology, and I went on with the general geology. And something that helped us to get acquainted was we found we had some similar tastes in literature. For example, he didn't consider it ridiculous that I had with me one of a three-volume set of Shakespeare's plays which my sister had given me. It's a small edition on thin paper. Also, he was fond of Boswell's Life of Johnson, and he knew about the works of George Borrow, which I've been very curious to do. And old is brought out in a more subtle way when mountain ash was full of red berries at that time, and I asked him whether the mountain ash was the same thing that the Scots called the rawin. He said, "Yes, those are the berries that Babby had in her hair." Well, I don't know how many of you know what that means. Babby was the heroine of a novel by James Barry, The Little Minister, which a good many people would recently have read at that time. And he, well, he not only had a taste in literature, but he wanted to his own writings to have literary quality, and he was not content to have them merely clear, but he didn't mind having a bit of elegance in them now and then. And I can remember as if through yesterday his looking over the galley proofs of his professional paper on the Bisbee Quadrangle in Arizona when they came to camp. And he looked over them this Sunday morning, and he came upon a passage which he had written like this. I say he wrote it like this because this is the way it is in the printed report. Once each year, just after the summer rains, the country awakes for a brief period from its long drought into a belated spring. Grasses wave over many of the hill slopes, and gay-colored flowers nod among the rocks. Well, that had been toned down by an assistant editor, the name of Michael McAfee, whom Foster remembers, in a pleasanter light than I do. And he had, I'm pretty sure about this. He had made it where grasses wave over many of the hill slopes. He had had it, grass grows on many of the hill slopes, and where gay-colored flowers nod among the rocks, he had put, and flowers appear. Well, I can see Ransom firmly penciling his comeback on the margin. He said, "Step." Underline. Grasses do wave and flowers do nod. And these changes completely destroy the flow and balance of this sentence. Pittsburgh was the next, and there Bill Emmons did the economic geology during 1906, while I did the general geology in 6, 7, and 8. And I don't know if I need to say anything about Bill Emmons. All of you, many of you must know his reputation at any rate, and he looked like the sort of a person he really was, a stocky, well-proportioned figure and a ruddy face, and kind of a slow laugh that was very expressive of him. It came rather frequently. I've said some things about him in a memorial at Foster Road. And, in 1907, MacDonald was along all the time. MacDonald was, I know he was Packer in 1907 because Rather was listed on the payroll as assistant packer. And there's my my second director. I don't know if I need to say anything particular about Rather in the field. It was 41 years after that when I turned 70 and retired for the first time. They had a little ceremony, I'll call it that, in the director's room. And Rather was director at the time, had been for a few years. And he produced a letter which I had written to him in answer to his application for a job. And I was extremely careful to tell him just what he had to expect, not to arouse any false hopes. And I told him he would have to pay his fare to and from the hill, the field, and he would get subsistence and camp and a certain monthly wage, which I'm sure was microscopic. And, well, then Rather read it aloud to the company. I could see that there was a sort of unconscious humor in it, but perhaps one of the reasons why he kept it, because he probably didn't foresee when he began to keep it that he was going to be a director. Well, next I'll jump to 1910, when I had one of the three parties, all of which were under Gale, examining land grant territory to see how much of it we could call mineral and get away from the Northern State Railroad. And Lawson came to me then as field assistant. He had previously worked in the East under Gregory, but that was his first Western work. And he was something of a, well, superficially a tenderfoot. But for instance, he told me one day how he had followed a path down a brook until he came to a cabin to a cottage on a small farm. Of course, Western language, he followed a trail down a creek until he got to a cabin on a small ranch. But he adapted himself pretty well and did very good work. And, he was very much liked by the camp hands. He told those stories around the campfire. I remember his telling in particular with some friend of mine about a scene in Don Giovanni where he perhaps carried a spear as a super. Eduard Reske waltzing around a very small tenor when he kept off the ground all the time. But in Washington, I became really more friendly with Lawson than I ever did with any administrative officer when he was administrating. And, we both had an interest in music. He knew enormously more about it than I did. He thought of being a professional musician at one time, played the flute very well, and he played piano pretty well. It was a great treat to hear him improvise, somewhat in the way that Alec Templeton used to do much later. Ever heard him? He was blind, and Alec Templeton was blind. And Laughlin was the leading spirit in the Pick and Hammer shows. I think he was mainly responsible for the crystallizing of the shows from near isolated skits at an annual dinner. And he had all the talents that could be put to work in a show. He used to direct the chorus and write his fair share of the doggerel, and he always was for many years the leading actor. He always impersonated one or more people, and it was rather a distinction to be impersonated by Laughlin. He kept that up until he became chief geologist, and perhaps the year before that, he gave a triple performance. He impersonated three people, and they required very, very different makeup, especially in respect of what they call theatrical hair. One of them was Mendy, who was bald. There wasn't any addition of hair necessary there. He was bald, and Laughlin was bald, but the shapes of their heads were very different. Laughlin had a regularly dome-shaped head, but Mendenhall had a sort of a high crest along the top of his head, and so in that part, Laughlin had what they call a bald-headed wig. And of course, it had to be shaped in just the right way. And I think it may have been rather a special job to get it up. And Mendenhall being very much taller than Laughlin, why Laughlin wore shoes with soles about things. Well, then he also impersonated Mrs. Fowler. And that was a very different Mrs. Fowler had a very abundant full-length head of hair, dark brown, and often had that kind of a wig, and made use of it. Mrs. Fowler had a way of putting her hand back and adjusting the knot when she felt that it was slipping a little out of place, and she did that about so often, and often did it probably a little more often. That was a part of his technique to catch some mannerism that identified the person to anybody who often saw it. Well, then there is one more. He was a German geologist whose name I haven't been able to recall. He was an expert on geese, on desert waste. And he had a shaggy head of grizzled hair and a beard to match. And Wilson probably found a red wig and false beard in stock. But at any rate, this German was a good sport, and he is perfectly delighted at the resemblance, and I'm quite sure that Moffat imitated his accent also, and he showed his delight by springing up in the middle of the audience where he was seated, and he said, "See, here am I, and there am I, and on the stage." Well, I won't say anything about Laughlin as an administrator or a geologist. I think he rated very high as both. In both, his personality was rather understated. The opposite might be said of George Otis Smith, for instance. But I think people sometimes didn't know that Laughlin was there and didn't appreciate him as much, perhaps, as he deserved to be. Now I'll go to the Yosemite Valley, where I went with Mattis in 1913, and I perhaps ought to apologize for pronouncing Mattis's name the way he did. Most people think of TH spells, and that was a sound that he simply could not have made. He thought he could pronounce the TH sound in this. He really didn't very well, but he didn't pretend to be able to pronounce the TH in thin. Well, that's a very trivial matter, but Mattis, as you all know, was one of the most skillful topographers that we ever had. That is, the most skilled in contour mapping. But he was a somewhat philosophical topographer, you might say. What I mean is that he got interested in the meaning of the forms he was contouring, and he had a doctrine that you should be sure to show and might perhaps exaggerate a little what he called the index forms. The U-shaped profile of a valley, for instance, or the forms that are due to jointing. And at heart, he was a geologist. He became more and more of one. And a turning point came in 1913. He had made the Yosemite Valley map on a scale of 1 to 24,000, one of the finest pieces of work that the topographic branch ever did, but erring a little bit by overinterpretation in places, as I had occasion to find out, and they were making it a, doing the work all over again, making the map based on air photos. But there he was, assigned the job of mapping the glacial deposits and interpreting the geologic history of the Yosemite Valley and the adjacent parts of the High Sierra, where the glaciers began. And he did, as many of you know, a wonderful piece of work there. It was rather long getting the report out, because he cared very much about how it was written. He was very, very much aware that writing is an art, that merely throwing facts on paper isn't enough, that facts are dead unless you get them understood, and you're more likely to get them understood if you state them in an interesting way. And he constantly had in mind the sort of people that he hoped would read his paper. Of course, they would be people of a rather high order of intelligence. There wasn't any cheap popularizing or talking down about his writing, but he produced what is surely one of the classics of geology in professional paper 160. Well, he had a very interesting personality, distinguished in every sense of the word. He had rather an aristocratic bearing, and he carried his head high. And I can't imitate him exactly, but he had a way of holding his head so that when he talked to a person two or three inches taller than himself, he seemed to be looking over his head. He was rather proud of his ancestry. It came out now and then. His mother was his mother's name. It was mostly his mother's line that he was proud of, and her name was Susanna Johanna van de Duus de Villa. I skipped one man that belongs with the Phillipsburg, and that's Joseph Pardee. It was in 1908, at the beginning of the season, at 4 hours in some building in Phillipsburg, and a man came in with his distinguished looking man. He was then about 37 years old, with his wife and a beautiful little girl, and three perhaps, and asked what the chances were of his getting a job. He told me something about his background. He'd been through the University of California and had no postgraduate training. And several years that had passed since then, he had had to make a living in one way or another, and had never had a chance to do the sort of work that in his heart he knew he wanted to do, and that was geology. I said I thought it could be arranged, and it was. I sent by telegraph, and so he assisted me during that season, and he went on and on, and but one thing that he did was get into work on the Western Phosphate deposit, in association with McKelvey, and McKelvey says that he was way ahead of his time in his thought about the origin of the deposit, that he formulated ideas that are pretty close to those that are generally accepted today. Then there's another more dramatic feature of his work. The very first paper he published was about the dim terraces that are visible on the slopes of the Missoula Valley. And he saw that those were left by a lake, which he called Lake Missoula. And he worked from time to time on the traces of that lake. And it was the subject of a paper in the GSA bulletin, and also the subject of his presidential address before the Geological Society of Washington. And, I've had, I think, a lot of luck in being associated with distinguished men, but I don't know that I can take any credit for that, for getting Pardee into the survey, but it seems a particularly lucky chance that he knocking it should be opened up to you. And he knocked, and I happened to be there to open the door.